All righty. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on a Friday afternoon. And we actually are hosting the show out on Pioneer Court because it is so nice this afternoon. Andrea Haines is here. Welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
All right. I should say we're really not outside, but we can see outside from where we are.
We almost could be. There are plenty of people out there, too.
It's nice because the coats are off. People are walking up and down, and spring is getting closer. So yep. Andrea is the editor of Blue Sky Innovation and also Red Eye. So Red Eye out today?
Red Eye comes out on Thursdays. We've got Hawkers out on Thursdays and Fridays with new copies. And the cover this week I think is really great. And it actually reminds me a little bit of your shirt. It's got a little sort of checked, blue and white check look going on. And it's pretty dramatic looking. I really like it.
What's the best story in the issue?
So it's all about brunch this weekend. There's a bunch of new places with brunch items that I think are worth checking out.
All right. So that's not what Blue Sky Innovation is. And I try to do a 2 or 3 word explanation, but it's about obviously innovation in the tech industry in Chicago, right?
Yep,
pretty good summary.
Exactly.
You can find it online and in the print edition as well. And one of the things that interests me this week is this, it's called Glimmer. And the story says, I think there are 4,500 dating sites or dating services in this country. Glimmer, it looks like maybe, is the only one set up for people with disabilities, right? Tell me about it.
Yeah, so Glimmer is doing something a little different in that it's sort of mixing communities. Like there are sort of disability-specific dating sites. This one is trying to kind of do both and integrate people with cognitive or physical disabilities, but also users that don't have them.
Oh, so there are some with just disabilities.
There are some that are just disability-focused.
I see, okay.
So this one is kind of mixing it up. It's a crowded space. I'd be nervous entering that space.
Would you?
Maybe,
and
but,
the guy who did it did it with $25,000.
Yep.
Of his own money out of his pocket.
Yep. Built out the app. They hired it out.
They got 5,000 people signed up.
Yep.
And he's hoping for bigger things.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I think he's looking at, you know, that phase two might include live events where you could bring people together, trivia nights, like some other options. And I think it's interesting when you think about maybe somebody with autism or Asperger's or something like that who's trying to be on a dating site and maybe not finding it as friendly to the way they want to share information. I think this is a somewhat familiar dating site, but maybe it creates a safer place to say who you are and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice because too many of us, I'm guilty, you know, don't look deep enough sometimes. And so why not help out? But I was interested, too, that I think it's 35% of the people who've signed up so far are people who do not have a disability. What is that about?
Yeah, so they're trying to also reach that group. And one thing that the founder mentioned was that there are people who, you know, if you know somebody who is, you know, has hearing loss or something, you might be more open to that. So it's like he's feeling like those are people that just maybe understand that people come in all types,
right,
and are more likely to sign up. Now, I would want to see that number over time. I feel like when people do sign up campaigns and things.
Right, it's a small population
kind of want,
now.
Exactly, so, precisely.
And the other thing that struck me, and I don't want to be insensitive or I'm careful to say the wrong word, but it seems to me that this population might be more susceptible to scam than other populations. But I mean, really, why not? I've been victims of scams too. So, but are there safeguards there, or is that an issue?
Yeah, I think that's a super interesting issue, and one I would imagine, you know, they may have to deal with. They are at the moment requiring Facebook sign-ins, which is, you know, kind of a way to make sure that you really know who people are,
right,
and perhaps that creates a little more sense of safety. I would say for any dating app, you know, use with care.
Yeah, and I guess anyone who's going to sign on or use anyone, they should know that there's a potential for.
Definitely.
Sometimes you're not swiping on the real person. Is that possible?
Don't always
I
know
can't
who
imagine
you're meeting.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go to the co-working spaces. Easy to find. I had a buddy of mine who was downtown in the South Loop area this week, and he was touring one. I don't remember the name, but, you know, they're trying to get him to join there.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, they've got beer on tap 24 hours. I said, oh, I got another buddy who works north of the Loop, and he's got one too. That's like the big thing. So these city co-working spaces are sort of omnipresent now. Not so much in the suburbs.
Yeah,
that's changing.
They're starting to show up in the suburbs. We did a story specifically on that, and definitely finding that, you know, it's a little bit crowded in the city. So people that are interested in opening the spaces from that perspective are seeing the suburbs as kind of fertile ground where they can get a toehold.
So it's a growth potential.
Exactly. They're seeing growth potential there. And they're finding some interesting things about maybe different ways people are using the spaces, and they've had to tweak up their models to make sure that they're appealing to that client better. But those seem to be starting to gain some ground.
I like the idea that it's sort of a different animal in the suburbs than it is in the city, right? The beer tap. It might be welcome to the suburbs, but they're looking for other things as well.
Yeah, and the city ones tend to be super focused on programming, I think, where they're, you know, people want to hang out after work, maybe hear a panel discussion or do a networking event, things like that. The suburban locations found a little bit less of that, where people maybe had families, they wanted to go home at night, they weren't as interested in hanging around maybe and, you know, drinking a beer at the office.
Work days in, they've got other things to go home and do.
Exactly.
The other thing is that just the furnishings of it or the makeup of it, it's a little more important to be a little more presentable in the suburbs. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, it sounds like a little bit fancier in the suburbs. Yeah. There's not as much IKEA furniture. And, you know, it's, I would assume, a little bit more of an established base of people. And, you know, we like it gritty in the city. And you guys like it nice and fancy in the suburbs. So.
Yeah, we just like, you be Zsa Zsa, I'll be Eddie.
Yeah.
I guess that's the point, though. Maybe it's the people who tend to live there tend to be at a different point in their life, so they're looking for something a little different.
Definitely.
And then there's another piece in Blue Sky about how to behave in these co-working spaces, which I think maybe could apply to any working space.
Yeah.
But explain for me a little bit, because co-working spaces are one of those things that I've been talking about for a long time, but I'm not sure of my grasp. So it's not just a place to go where there's a desk and an outlet and things like that. The idea is that you're forming a community, you're mingling, you're getting to know each other, right? And then you're feeding off of one another. So rather than just a remote office, it's sort of a remote lab in a way.
Yeah, it kind of creates a quasi-office environment. And that's what's interesting about some of the etiquette issues, where you are maybe seeing some of the same people every day and you're hanging out with the same people every day. But by the same token, you don't necessarily have a unifying boss or a unifying company culture that kind of keeps you all on the same page.
No one to say, hey, Andrea, it's time to,
exactly.
It's time to throw away your yogurt in the refrigerator. It's been too long.
Yeah.
So people are relying instead. It's more communist. They have to take care of each other.
A little bit.
And what's the, and what are the, so the first advice that jumped out of me is like, just be quiet. If I'm working next to you, I don't necessarily want to hear you.
Yeah, there's noise, of course. That's a problem probably in every office. And there too, you just get cultural differences, right? If you need to be super serious on the phone and somebody else needs to be a little more freewheeling, again, you don't have that same company culture perhaps underlying what you're doing.
So if you're looking for a co-working space, do you, in my world, the biggest option would be location. But is culture important as well? I mean, do you shop by culture?
Yeah, I think visiting it would be important. We have a co-working guide where we have a number of these spaces online. So you can find those in the Blue Sky Vault, which you can access via our website. And like, we will allow you to sort by like, can you get a daily pass? Or, you know, many of them will offer a certain amount of free time or ways that you can kind of come check it out and get a feel for
it. And so the benefit of them is, and going back to the whole community of it, right? I mean, you could work from your home. You might go a little insane, so you need the interaction. But but you're also networking and meeting people with whom you might sell your product, which is another warning. Don't try too hard to sell.
That was one of the faux pas that we encountered people talking about, that sometimes people are a little too aggressive about trying to sell their services. So there's always that certain art to networking. You want to be there and get to know people in a gentle way and not come on too strong with pushing whatever it is that you're selling.
The bottom line is, if you're going to a co-working space because you want to be around people, you're going to be around people.
And you have to behave.
Andrea Haynes, thanks for coming by.
Thanks,
a great
Steve.
Weekend.
You too.
We'll see you next week.
Yeah, lovely weekend coming up.
It's the business. She can't wait. You cannot wait, can you? She
can't
cannot
wait.
It's 12:21. This is the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Adam Ockstein is in the studio. He is the founder, the CEO, the man behind, the brains really behind StratX. And
brains? I don't know about that.
He's been here a few times. Adam, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
So we were just talking a little college basketball. You are a Maryland man.
I am. So you're the turtle.
Fear the turtle. People are fearing the turtle this year.
Yeah, it's maybe a down year for the Big Ten. I don't know, but we're playing Wisconsin on Sunday for hopefully the rights to represent number one seed in the tournament. Purdue might have something to say about that.
Isn't it kind of nice? I mean, you leave the school and the school joins a conference to come to you.
It's fantastic.
Yeah,
I have that, you know, gravity pull.
You do, and you used it at StratX, right? You guys started in 2007.
Yeah.
Right. Tell me what StratX is first. Tell me what StratX was first at the beginning.
Oh, boy. Well, going back to 2002, when the name still existed, we provided sales consulting for technology startups.
Okay.
And when I moved to Chicago, there was no technology here back in 2003. So we started providing HR software and services to small businesses that didn't have an HR department. And really, you know, we wanted to walk in and say, there's Steve, the president, there's John, the CFO, who handles HR? And the both of you pointing each other, right. So talk to them. And then we built out our own software application to provide, you know, more comprehensive recruitment all the way to termination and Cobra software for businesses.
And that was when people really weren't doing that so much.
No,
right?
we were doing a lot of education early on. And, you know, we were the first one in the marketplace to offering those services.
Right. Well, now, Adam, I can't sort of turn around without being smacked in the face by someone else advertising
it. HR software sexy now. Who would have thunk it?
And you were one of the first guys to come up with
it. Yeah. And we made a mistake clearly 7-8 years ago. We should have gotten outside capital, and we didn't. And the marketplace caught up to us.
Oh, tell me why that, what you would have done with that capital that you weren't able to do.
You know, first to market isn't always first to market. It's who has the largest megaphone, who can screamer first to market, and has right. the sales and marketing muscle behind that. So we were first to market, but you're talking to the sales team at the time. We didn't build a sales or marketing army. We needed capital to do that. And the marketplace caught up, and everyone, you know, came out and said, we built this great first-to-market software. And we're like, wait a second. We did it like 5 years ago.
You didn't have a megaphone in your hand.
Exactly.
So why didn't you do it then?
You know, I didn't want to be beholden to someone else with outside capital.
Right.
You know, it was a little bit, you know, we just came out of the, you know, the Great Recession was occurring. So it would have been probably a hard time to get capital. In 2010, 11, we should have. Just a bad business decision. There's no other way to sugarcoat
it. Is that the only one? The only one you've ever made, probably?
The only one I've ever made today.
But, well, I was going to say, too, there's this beauty of possession, or maybe that's what you sort of said in different words, but of ownership.
Yeah.
This is my baby. And when you start looking for outside help, you sort of, it's like someone who writes a book and then sells it to the movie industry. Right.
It's dramatically changed.
It's dramatically changed.
Yeah.
And so if you create something you love, it's kind of hard to give away some control for that.
Yeah, no doubt. But some of that control is, if you want to see your baby flourish and grow and scale, you got to give up some
of that.
You
got to do it.
Yeah.
If you want to go to the movie house and see your film.
Yeah.
And so, but now then what we're talking about a little bit then is taking where you are and rebooting to move into another direction and to find another niche, which was something you guys are doing.
Yeah, so we can either be our opportunity to be a commodity play as the industry gets more and more, as you know, you said you can't turn around
right.
and not run into a company. That could have been our choice. We could build a sales army and go out and do land grab, and that becomes a price war. Or we can say, what do we do really well and slightly pivot? And what we did is we focused on what I call gray collar. So it's the restaurant, retail, hospitality workforce, and providing software that we do already, but add a lot of features and functionalities that are unique to the challenges involved in that gray collar labor.
Because they're working, you know, so many different locations.
Distributed labor,
right.
You know, where my labor costs become my biggest lever, whether I'm profitable or not, is how I can't control my real estate cost, my food cost, my beverage cost, but I can control my labor mix based on how sales are doing in any given day.
And how's it going for you?
It's going well. The marketplace is responding nicely. We have a sales megaphone now. We have a marketing megaphone, and we have a product development team that's executing on that business.
Your office is just across the street, but from what I read, you keep adding some employees that maybe you're going to be taking a floor out on the Sears Tower or something.
Maybe we'll just take over the whole Sears Tower.
Actually, there's room in this building if you buy the condos. So it's working well. You pivoted. You found a new direction to go. Talk to other people who are out there who might be bootstrapping right now and trying to figure out how to get from where you were to where you are now without those intervening years.
Well, you know, you got to be really, really attuned to your customers, right? So you got to, if your customers are telling you turn left and you're digging your heels in and you're not willing to turn
because
left.
Because you're convinced that turning right is the right thing to do.
Right. That's the Steve Jobs type. You know, for every Steve Jobs example of I'm not going to listen to my customers, I'm not going to build a better horse, I'm going to build a car for them, analogy. That's you know, you can hold to that, but in reality, if your customers are telling you they want something, you should listen and maybe pivot a bit.
So that is that's the advice from you, and hopefully you have a great 2017.
Thanks,
we'll
Steve.
See you again before the year's
I hope
out, right?
So.
Good luck on Sunday.
Yes.
Sunday or Saturday?
Sunday. Fear the turtle.
I think badgers can kill turtles, can't they? I don't think that'll be a problem.
Hide in our shell.
Is it up here or down over there?
It's in Madison.
Okay. Well, good luck. Alrighty, thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It's 12:37 on a Friday afternoon. You only have to stay inside for a few more hours. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. I was in London last summer. My daughter was studying there, and I'm there with my wife, and I post something on, I think, Twitter, and I get a message from a friend of mine, Gary Mills, who said, "Where are you?" I said, I'm in Covent Garden. He says, "I'm in Soho. I'll be there in 10 minutes. On Wednesday, I was in Glenwood, and I get a tweet from my friend Gary Mills, and he said, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm in Glenwood." He said, "I'm in Poland. I'll be there in 2 days." And now here he is in the studio. Gary Mills, welcome back. Nice to see you again.
Thank you very much.
Bring the mic a little closer to you. So who would have thought, you know, we've known each other for probably, well, more than 20 years.
Maybe 25.
Right. We were both very young and doing different things. Well, sort of different. I was a little more similar, but back then. And now here you are as the co-founder of this Pinnacle Performance Company, where you studied drama at DePaul.
I did.
And acted for a while. I saw you on ER once.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of.
Yeah.
And then you've developed into this sort of company where you help business leaders, not just business leaders, just about anyone, sort of communicate, how to learn to communicate effectively when it comes to business or really just life.
Yeah, my background was as a professional actor in TV and film and theater, mostly in Chicago, but also a little bit in LA and New York. And then, yeah, about 12 years ago, a friend of mine, David Lewis, who came up with the idea to let's take all these things that actors know, how to be engaging and confident and persuasive, and bring it into the corporate environment.
And it's done very well for you.
Yeah, so we're now in 40 countries. We train in 6 languages all around the world.
Do you train more overseas than you do here?
No, it's mostly U.S., but we have an office in London, and we have people in Dubai and India, so okay. We have offices around the world.
So there's that, and that's what Gary does now. But the reason he'd sent me a text was because you had an essay published at Forbes.com looking at President Trump. And, you know, politics aside, here's a guy who's been very effective at communicating. He's also sometimes really stepped in it when it comes to communicating. So he's kind of an extreme example in both ends.
Yeah, the article came about because everywhere I went in the world doing training, I kept getting asked,
right,
"Hey, what is your opinion of Donald Trump as a communicator? Or how did he win this election? Or do you think he's going to win before the election?" And so I decided to just do this article for Forbes so that when I get asked the question, I can just say, go read the article.
Read the article, Forbes.com. I mean, when you look at him, when you look at the skills in what you teach, and you look at how he communicates, I would imagine you see things that would make you think he's a great student, but then you see other things that sort of trouble you.
So where you have to start is he won.
Right. So not only did he win, he won against great odds.
He won against great odds.
Against great machines.
Absolutely.
And that's communication?
Yes, for sure. As I talk about in the article, there's a couple things he did really well that, in my opinion, made him win the election, as well as a couple things that I think are going to be trouble for him as a leader going forward.
He put his slogan on his cap.
Make America great again, right? Any little kid walking down the street, you could ask them what Trump's slogan was, and they knew what it was. Ask them what it meant, that's a trickier thing.
Right. When you're teaching someone to communicate with others, though, a business leader, I would imagine they need to have that second layer.
Yes, for sure.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. You know, if you're running a meeting or giving a presentation, we always tell people to boil it down to a headline.
Right.
Right. What do you want me to walk out thinking at the end of your meeting, at the end of your presentation? And that's what he did really, really well, was make America great, make America great, make America great.
And so there's clarity of message. So that's something he did very well,
yeah.
Right? Give me another idea of what he does well.
So with the clarity of message, I actually got called out when the article came out. A writer friend of mine reached out to me, and she pushed back on this a little bit. She said, I disagree. She said, I don't think he was clear. He didn't make sense. His proposals didn't make sense. To which I said, it wasn't about details with him.
Right.
His message that he wanted you to walk away with, make America great again. That's it. And he was effective at getting that across. There were no details or specifics, but that wasn't his intent.
Well, and so so that sounds like you're almost talking more about marketing than you are one-on-one communication, right? Because if you're marketing, you want the brand to have a short slogan that means something with the people who receive it.
I think he knew people are not going to go to a website and read a 51-point plan about immigration.
Right. Hillary Clinton had pages no one went to.
I think he knew that wasn't going to happen, but Make America Great Again sounds good. Let's do it. And in the article, I talk about how, you know, that's a recycled slogan.
It's not even
new. He claimed he came up with it, but Reagan and Bush used it in 1980.
So for someone to claim that they came up with something that already existed would be someone who exudes a very confident presence, which is the other thing you talk about.
Definitely one of his strengths as a communicator, very confident, even when the facts don't quite add up or the policies don't quite make sense. Very confident in his delivery. I think that's one of the things that attracted the people who voted for him. They like that.
Right. And they like the fact that he stays with that and that he remains in the face of so many obstacles or other facts. He remains very confident in what he presents.
Yes, for sure. For the people who like him, they like that about him.
And what they don't like about him, or what you say maybe isn't so good, is he has a lack of empathy. And our leaders, we like to see someone who, well, Bill Clinton said, I can feel your pain.
Yeah, we teach leadership all around the world. And one of the traits of a good leader is empathy, right? Empathy for your staff, empathy for your team, empathy for your partners, for your clients. You got to put yourself in their shoes. It's emotional intelligence. And that's one of the strangest things about the campaign is he had no empathy for anyone.
Right.
He would find your one vulnerability, whether it's, you know, the Miss America who was overweight or Marco Rubio who's short. And he would just go at that one vulnerability just like the biggest bully on the schoolyard.
Okay, so then maybe it's not that important. Or is it?
What?
I mean, if he exhibited a lack of empathy and did so well, is it as important as you think?
Yeah, so it certainly wasn't important to the people who put him into office. My argument in the article was, going forward, can you be the leader of a nation as diverse as the United States and not have empathy for people who are different than you?
And that is a question yet to be answered.
That's a question to be answered. We're going to find out.
So the communication has worked well for him to get to where he is.
For sure.
The other thing you say that he does not show well that leaders do sort of goes along with it, I guess, in a way, humility.
Yeah, that's another thing that great leaders know they don't have to have all the answers. They can surround themselves with people smarter than them, and they're comfortable doing that. And Trump never admits he's wrong. I don't know if you saw the press conference last night. I saw parts of it, and at one point he said he won the biggest electoral landslide since Reagan, and the reporter from NBC stood up and said, yeah, that's actually not true, and gave him the numbers from Obama, had more, and he said, well,
Bush,
I'm talking about Republicans, and he said, well, actually, George H.W. Bush had more than you as well, and his response was, well, somebody told me that.
Right, so he didn't take it for himself, said, I'm mistaken.
It's not, people are okay with a leader saying, I made a mistake.
Okay, so if he did so well doing the first two things and in spite of the second two things, what do you tell someone the next time you go to an office and they want to be a leader and they say, well, look, it worked for Trump. Why can't I do it as well?
That's a great question. And that's the thing from a communication standpoint, we're still trying to untangle, right? And figure out as a leader, how is this going to work? Because in a lot of ways, we're in uncharted territory.
Right.
We've never seen someone who communicates in this manner. In fact, if he would have hired me to run his campaign before this all happened, and said, but I don't want to win. Tell me what to do so I don't win because I don't want this job. I would have done all these things. Just be cruel, show no humility, show no empathy, just be mean, tell things that don't seem to be the truth, and you'll escape. You won't have any problem not being president.
So I guess what this essay you wrote then is something that catches Donald Trump mid-sentence.
For sure.
Right? So his sentence is not complete, but the first few phrases have been going pretty well for him.
Yes, I think so. And again, I wrote this essay just as he was taking office.
Right.
So it came out, you know, 10 days later or whatever it was.
Nothing holds up more than 12 hours.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I was like, get this out there before something changes. And
G. Riley Mills, Gary Mills, he's the co-founder of Pinnacle Performance Company. Also, the Pin Drop Principle, which we've talked about a few times.
Yes.
In our times together here. How do people find more information?
Go to Pinnacle, the Pinnacle website, www.pinper.com.
P-I-N-P-E-R.
That is correct.
All right, big boy. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Thanks very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, just about 12:51 in the afternoon on this Friday. The weekend is not far away, and the weather's going to hold. Elise Glink is on a phone line. She joins us, often on Thursdays, but you got bumped by President Trump yesterday, Elise.
I did. It was quite the event.
It was that. We were just talking a little bit about it with Gary Mills about the president's ability to communicate and what he does well and what he doesn't do well. And it was kind of interesting talking to Gary. It's like, well, it's kind of mid-sentence right now. The things that he does well have really brought him a long way, brought him here. And we'll see if they'll continue to carry him through his 4 years or 8 years in the White House. We'll see. I don't know. I would imagine the economy will have a lot to do with that. And one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is the housing situation in the country. Census Bureau out with a report earlier this week. Housing starts for January were actually down, 2.6% from December. That's probably not the sort of news economists were hoping for.
Yeah, I mean, overall, it was up 10% from the prior year. And what I've been talking to housing economists about is where they'd really like to see the numbers. So typically you want to see housing starts, which is shovels in the ground, turning things over and starting to build. And you'd like to see that number right now between 1.5 and 1.6 million. So 1.2 isn't bad, but not all of those houses will get built, and certainly not by a long shot. And then not all of them will get sold. So this year we're seeing, just to put it in perspective for everybody, we're seeing about 1 million new households form, a little bit more than that, actually. And that's pretty much in line with where it was, 10 years ago, before we had the housing crisis. So all these people are starting to figure out that they want to, find places to live. On the other hand, we don't have enough housing inventory, places for them to buy. And they're doing a lot of renting, but when it comes to new construction, this year we're only going to sell, and there's a difference between building the houses and selling them, but we're only going to sell about 640,000 new homes.
So
you can see that you really want that number to go up fast.
So the built homes that are unoccupied just sit vacant?
Well, they don't actually all get built. So you get started, you pull your permits and you get started, and for a variety of reasons, the lender will want to see you pre-sell these homes and ahead of time, or they don't actually really get built. It's not like there are a lot of homes sitting out there not bought.
Right.
It's just that they don't actually get finished.
Elise, go ahead.
I was just going to add that really the number of new homes that you want to see being built in the U.S. is somewhere about 800,000 to 1.2 million a year. So if you start about 1.5 million, you'd want to see 1 million to 1.2 million actually get built and sold. And we're nowhere near that number.
And that is because people are staying in the homes that they're currently living. Because they're underwater, or they like the interest rate where they've refinanced, or what is it that leads to that?
Well, the existing home sales are about, 5.5 million. And so they're creeping back to where they were. But what we're seeing is that all these buyers are now starting to think about buying, but there aren't very many homes to sell. And so you would really rather see a lot of new homes come on the market. You'd also like to see existing homeowners, like, say, baby boomers whose, kids like me and you have moved out of the house,
right,
trade down. But they're not doing that either, because for them, they've got a 2.75% fixed interest rate, and it's too cheap to stay. Like, I can stay in my bigger house for a lot less money than if I traded down to a smaller, it would be much more expensive for me to live in. So a lot of people around the country are facing that. That means the trade-up buyers below them can't move up to anything, and that means the first-time buyers don't have anything to buy on their end. And so you see this ripple effect going down, where you just don't have enough houses, new or existing, for people to buy.
So what is it that needs to be done? I mean, is there a way that this can be fixed?
It's slowly, slowly, slowly coming back. So people talk about real estate as being these overnight success stories, but any building that you see going up downtown was probably between 7 and 10 years in the making. It takes that long. And we see lots of cranes and lots of beautiful apartment and, condo buildings going up in downtown. But you have to acquire the land, go through the building department, get the permissions. You've got to actually hire an architect. And you go through all these different steps and processes, and then you have to find the financing. And it could really take you 5 to 10 years to build a building. And so that's why it takes so long to kind of right the ship.
Is that the situation everywhere, or is it, I would imagine it's different by neighborhood, obviously, but I know that there are a lot of new condos coming in the market downtown Chicago.
There are. Chicago, downtown Chicago is kind of having a resurgence, both of expensive rental properties, but also expensive condos, all coming back. There was a lot of excess capacity back in 2007, 8, 9, and 10, and all of that has gotten pretty much absorbed, and now some new stuff's going up. And we could see the market slow down a bit because a bunch of these buildings are going to come online right away at the same time, and it'll take a while for them to get absorbed. But around the country, what you're seeing, and I'm in Denver today, actually, Denver is the fastest housing market in the country right now. Homes are going on the market and off it within about 6 weeks from the time somebody makes an offer to close.
Wow.
It is lightning fast out here, and the property prices are zooming. And so in most of the country, that's what you're seeing. Not enough homes to buy. Prices are going up.
Elise Glink, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it. Have a safe trip back.
Hey, thanks. Have a great weekend.
You bet. Elise is the publisher of ThinkLink.com, the CEO of Best Money Moves. That's an HR app for businesses. They help employees measure their financial stress and then dial that stress down a little bit. Check it out. You can find out more at ThinkLink.com.